It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The recent release of the PBS documentary, The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, piqued our curiosity about the Black Panther Party and what it was like to be a part of the movement in the turbulent 60s. The party was formed 50 years ago, in 1966. By 1968, the head of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, called the Black Panthers the greatest threat to the internal security of the United States. At its inception, the Black Panther Party's core practice was having its armed citizens' patrols monitor the behavior of police officers and challenge police brutality in Oakland, California. But they also instituted a variety of social programs, including a free breakfast for children program and community health clinics. The Black Panthers opened headquarters in major cities throughout the United States and had some influence in Pittsburgh with an office in Homewood, Brushton, which protested police brutality and established a free breakfast program for needy families here. I'm joined now in studio by T. Rashad Birdsong, a member of the Black Panthers who joined the party in 1968 after serving in Vietnam. He is a Pittsburgh native and is now the president and CEO of the Community Empowerment Association in Homewood. T. Rashad Birdsong, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul, for having me.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH at WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Any questions or comments you have about the Black Panthers, 412-246-2002. T. Rashad Birdsong, what led you to join the Black Panther Party? And when you did join, what kind of an opportunity did you see this as?
Well, as we can remember, especially for those of us that's over 50 years old, that in the 60s was right on the heels of the rights movement and right beginning the Black Consciousness and Black Liberation Movement, in addition to the anti-war movement, in addition to the student movement. There was national liberation struggles that was going on in Africa, and even in France, there was worker strikes that was going on at the same time. So that air was an air of people that was engaging in revolutionary and progressive struggle. I myself had left Pittsburgh, joined the Army, and went to Europe. And on my 18th birthday, I was sent to Vietnam. And of course, you know, coming from, you know, a non-violence and engaging community at the time, going into actually war theater, then that helped kind of change how I saw the world. When we went there, we was trained to kill. That they said that the Vietnamese, they was gooks, they was red eyes, they was slant eyes, they was communists. And being young and uninformed at the time when I went in, I didn't know the difference.
Why did you join?
Well, you know, like during that time also, you know, the Army or either the steel mill was when young African-American boys and men went to. And I had chose to go into.
That was it. That was the choice?
That was the choice at the time that was given. And we know there was a lot of segregation in those days also. I'm originally from Braddock in Rankin area. So it was a strong blue-collar, segregated working community. And of course, you know, some of the schools that young Black boys went to didn't promote, you know, going to college, more technical careers and those type of things. So you was really driven and drove to more vocational type training or either the military. And that's how I ended up going to Vietnam at the time. But my experience there was an experience that I have never, ever experienced before. The level of a human carnage that I saw, the type of savagery, the type of non-caring for other human beings. I had never been exposed to that before. So as you can imagine, at the age of 18, I began to really weigh my purpose in this world and whether I was going to continue to be in this world, because there was a lot of soldiers that was dying in Vietnam, or a lot of soldiers that lost limbs and legs in Vietnam, and the same thing on the other side. And I like to tell this story. I was also over there when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and we was in a hooch, having, you know, drinking some beer, and the mama-san and papa-san who runs that there gave me a flyer, And when I looked on the flyer, it showed the resistance and the riots that was going on in this country. It showed the dogs being sicked on women, the fire hoses, and engagement from the National Guard and the police. And despite this man and me not speaking the same language, he just said same, same. So for the first time in my life, I began to look at the human relationship and humanity between men, opposed to this is my enemy because I'm in Vietnam and this happened to be Vietnamese. And that was a life-changing event for me when that occurred in Vietnam. And matter of fact, after that, I refused to participate in the war. That's led to other things, but that's when I kind of shut down.
So while you were in Vietnam, these Vietnamese people, and they were, I'm assuming, South Vietnamese,
yes,
showing you pictures of what was happening in the United States.
Right.
And they were saying, you know, you might be here on our behalf, but by the way, sir,
right,
here's what's happening,
yes,
to African Americans,
exactly,
in the U.S.
Now, some people would say that was propaganda, but it was the truth.
Well, that was clearly those things were going on.
Right. That was going on. So I began to look at the contradiction, and that heightened my understanding and my consciousness. And I became angry, and I began to see how I was being exploited. And that led me to the decision that I made once I left Vietnam to join the Black Panther Party.
So you got back to the United States. If you were in Vietnam when Martin Luther King was assassinated, that was 1968. So
yes.
When did you get back to the U.S.?
Around that same period of time, maybe a couple of months after that.
You were discharged?
Well, I had 6 months to go left. However, they did let me leave early because once I came home, I refused to participate.
And how did that go over?
And not participating?
Yes.
Well, it just happened that my company commander also was in Vietnam. So they kind of thought I was suffering from PTSD from being in the war.
Did they have that term back then?
Yes, they had that term back there. That's an old term. Unfortunately, we really is not treating it at the level we should. That's why we see what's going on amongst our veterans in this country, but also what's going on amongst, you know, young African-American and brown boys in a lot of these urban communities that we see where there's a lot of violence. So the PTSD is a real issue that needs to be addressed also. Anyone that's been subjected to any type of traumatic experience normally suffer somewhat of some PTSD.
So they acknowledged that you were going through this and in 1968 after you got back from Vietnam, and they let you out early.
Yes, they did. What didn't happen, though, they didn't recommend any treatment at all. And normally what occurs after a war situation, there's counseling, there's groups, and there's treatment also. Unfortunately, the men that came home from Vietnam didn't receive that. And as you remember, the war was real controversial. So a lot of these here young men that came home, they wasn't embraced as being heroes. They was demonstrations. They was baby killers. So they was caught into that political quagmire of the politics of this here country. And unfortunately, in addition to the PTSD that they suffered in country, when they came home, they internalized what was going on in this country also. So that led to further diagnosis down the line of depression, substance abuse, and we go on and on and on.
So what happened with you?
Well, what saved me, interesting enough, Paul, I think, is when I joined the Black Panther Party. I was located in Washington State.
You were in the Seattle area?
Seattle area. And I visited the chapter when I actually was in the service. And I started reading the newspaper. I started participating in the political education classes. I started selling the newspaper. I started going to the free breakfast program. I started networking, you know, with other members. And I think this is what actually was therapeutic for me, because it really helped me deal with some of the ghosts that I brought back from Vietnam also.
And how did they feel about having you get involved with them? What was their reaction when you showed up at the Black Panther's doorstep?
Well, of course, there was policies that we had then where, you know, you had to sell so many newspapers. You had to participate in so many political education classes. You had to engage in the broader community in terms of the work that we did. That all was part of membership. So you just couldn't go and join the Black Panther Party. You know, there was a level of things you had to go through.
You had
first.
To demonstrate that you were earnest. About
exactly. And matter of fact, later on through the years, that's what happened to the party that led to this demise, because you had a lot of folks join the party for various other reasons other than the principles and the platform of the party.
Sure. And we'll get into some of that. But I'm curious, what did it mean for a young, disillusioned veteran of Vietnam, African-American man, to be a Black Panther?
Well, you know what? Like I said, it was the time. You had a lot of young people in this country that's real idealistic. You had a lot of us that was trying to establish identity in this country. You have a lot of us. We was thrown into a situation of having to be adults. The average age of a Black Panther Party member was 18, 19 years old. We was teenagers. So there was a lot of things that we just didn't understand, and we wanted to understand it. And this was a time where young people matured. We was very immature, very idealistic in terms of how government ran and why we saw the police doing what they was doing in our community, and how the state apparatus and the institution all levered, you know, the type of things they need to suppress certain communities. So all these things was new to us. So we just was willing to engage on the heels of the civil rights movement, but we wanted to see something new and different for young people in this country.
I'm sure for a lot of white Americans, the sight of Black Panthers, particularly when they first emerged on the scene, was probably somewhat threatening and intimidating.
Yes, yes.
But I would think that from the standpoint of a young Black man, that this was a sensible response, or seemed to be a sensible response to police brutality.
Sure.
And a very empowering thing.
Well, that's the key word, empowering, because you have to remember at the time frame here, we're talking about the heels of the Civil Rights Movement. Now, the Civil Rights Movement was to address segregation in this country, the lack of inclusion in this country, to establish a place in this country. So when we saw something that we can claim as our own, that can empower us to have a voice, I think that was the attraction to the Black Panther Party, because historically, young people didn't have the voice that we had in terms of when we was in the Black Panther Party.
And, of course, one of the things that was an integral part of the Black Panthers was the very militant stance that the organization took, and the fact that these young people were armed. They carried their own weapons.
Yes.
Having served in Vietnam, I'm guessing you knew your way around an automatic weapon. Did you carry a weapon when you were with the Black Panthers?
Yes, I did. But most Americans did. Most Americans now carry weapons. This is a country that promotes people's rights to have weapons. And that's what we demonstrated. At that time, you can carry weapons openly. So not only did we carry weapons as a defensive in our community to protect ourselves, but it was our constitutional right. So we was challenging the system and being able to carry weapons. And that's kind of what led to a couple of the times that we had to go to the state in Sacramento and other places and demonstrate that in front of our legislators.
Right. And that was in the documentary, there's that famous footage of the Black Panthers carrying the weapons into the California State Assembly.
That was a demonstration. We didn't go there to commit any violence. It was a demonstration of the right to bear arms.
And was this something that was a response to what police were doing? The idea that we are going to meet you at the level at which you are intimidating us. Mm-hmm. We are responding as an organization to the way that people in the Black community have been brutalized.
Well, first of all, it was a shock for the police to see armed Black men in the community observing them while they did what they did. But then you got to understand also now that a lot of these here police, particularly on the West Coast, have migrated from the South. So they brought, you know, the biases and the discrimination with them. And now we're talking about the West Coast. Los Angeles and Oakland and in the San Francisco area.
They had migrated from the South?
Most of them did, yeah, a lot of them. And then some of these here was military folks also. And their whole job was to suppress the black community. So, it was killings in our community. African-American men and women was being beat up brutally in our community. And there was a pattern and there was a history of this occurring. So this was a strategy. Coming together, the party coming together and say, look, we have to begin to bear arms and demonstrate that we will defend any unjust attack on us or our community.
And was it a watershed moment just in terms of, by this time, Martin Luther King had been assassinated. He had always advocated nonviolence.
Yes.
And that was particularly how the civil rights movement had manifested itself as a nonviolent movement. Was this a way of saying that the frustration has gotten so bad that we're done being peaceful. We're not looking to commit acts of violence, but we're ready to defend ourselves instead of standing in front of the water cannons and the things that and the dogs that the police were sicking on, particularly on members of the African American community.
Well, that was one position, but another position was the level of political maturity. In our growth and development, we begin to study other revolutionary movements throughout the country. We visit Cuba, North Korea, China, Africa, and we kind of start to look at how other governments was protecting themselves against these type of atrocities. So in addition to taking a stand and being frustrated, it was a calculated frustration. That means that we didn't just do it just to do it. We really had an ideological position and understanding why we needed to take a stance at that level.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. My guest is T. Rashad Birdsong. He's a member of the Black Panthers who joined the party in 1968 after serving in Vietnam. He is a Pittsburgh native and now president and CEO of the Community Empowerment Association in Homewood. We'll continue with our discussion of his story as a member of the Black Panthers, the history of the organization, and also take your calls at 412-246-2002. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the history of the Black Panther Party, which turns 50 years old this year. It started in 1966 in October, so this October will be the official 50th anniversary. And I'm joined in studio by a member of the Black Panther Party, a Pittsburgh native, T. Rashad Birdsong. He is now president and CEO of the Community Empowerment Association in Homewood. We're talking about his experiences with the Black Panthers and how the organization evolved and what eventually broke it apart in the 1970s. You can join the conversation with a question or comment at 412-246-2002. And let's go to Stephen in Homestead. Stephen, welcome. You are on with T. Rashad Birdsong.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a very sort of straightforward, simple question, which is, is there a place for the Black Panther Party during a time that this time, which is in its own way critical as it was in the 60s?
Say it again.
Stephen is asking if there's a place for the Black Panther Party today. And Stephen, I don't want to mischaracterize what you're saying, but it sounds as though he's saying you have a lot of this same issues, police brutality. I mean, it's not like that issue has gone away.
Yes, I think the place today for a Black Panther Party in the history is, as we know, a lot of the millennium young folks are confronting some of the same issues that we had to confront in the early 60s. Matter of fact, when the first Panther was killed, little Bobby Hutton, he had his hands up when he was shot by the Oakland police, similar to Michael Brown having his hands up. I think we're a little bit more politically educated now, and there's multiple, levels that we have to work from. But I do think that we as a community have to take a stance. And we haven't begun to talk about the level of coalition building that the Black Panther Party did. I think that it can't be a narrow nationalist approach. I think got to be a multicultural approach to talk about the respect of, you know, human beings across the board, particularly those are the most oppressed, which, of course, we know is Black Americans and Brown Americans. So I think that there is a place, but I think that before that we can carry it to the level that the Black Panther Party did, we have to really begin to review that and assess what the best approach should be.
Rashad, how would you compare the Black Lives Matter movement of today to what the Black Panthers were doing 50 years ago?
Well, I think that the movement today is very informational. I think a lot of young folks is developing a level of consciousness and awareness. I think there's a little bit more organizing due to social media. Of course, in the 60s, we didn't have social media. So I think that they're able to communicate, you know, a little bit better than we was. I think that they're a little bit more politically astute than we are. They're really challenging public officials. They're challenging institutional racism. So I think that they're doing a great job in terms of bringing it to the awareness and consciousness of the American people that we still have a lot of work to do in this country around institutional racism.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with T. Rashad Birdsong, former member of the Black Panthers. Although, is it correct to say former member?
Well, if you ever was a Black Panther Party member, you always going to be a Black Panther Party member.
Who were the people that you met in the Black Panthers? Did you have an opportunity to meet some of the key leadership figures like Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, who were the founding members of the party?
Yeah, we got a chance to go to, I was from Seattle, but eventually I did migrate to the Oakland and San Francisco area. Yes, we got a chance to meet, you know, Bobby and also Huey, David Hilliard, Junior Hilliard, Elaine Brown, Masai Huet, which was part of the Central Committee. And we also, the story, though, that really need to be told is the rank and file. Those are those regular Panthers. They wasn't part of the national leadership, but throughout the country, those were the young men and the women that kept the free breakfast program going. Those was the folks that was getting up 4:30 in the morning that was doing the cooking. Those are the ones that sold the party paper. Those are the ones that made sure that health centers was built in our communities. So we still have to talk about the rank and file of the party because those was the ones that did the day-to-day daily work on the ground.
And as the years went on, Huey Newton went to prison. Mm-hmm. He got out, and he began to disavow some of what the Black Panthers were doing. He wasn't particularly enamored with the free breakfast program, for example. He wanted to see more of a militant, combative stance taken by the organization. And in the documentary, and I can't remember which former Panther it was, referred to Huey Newton as effing crazy. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair characterization of happened?
No, I don't think that's fair. I think at some point, because of the attacks from the state apparatus and the security forces in this country, a lot of Panthers, you know, got to the point that they felt that it was time for revolution. It was time to fight back. And I think that we still had some of us that said that we wanted to build, you know, the organization. We wanted to connect to, you know, the political apparatus. So I think that was Huey's position. You know, so he never was anti-survival programs. We understood that the survival programs wasn't revolutionary, but we understand that at that time, there were some basic fundamental bread and butter issues that our community did not have. We was not ready to actually fight the state apparatus. The whole key to this year movement was to heighten the consciousness and awareness of the people of this here country. We wasn't trying to commit, you know, the quote, revolutionary suicide. We was trying to lead by example. So the vanguard, because we was the vanguard, unfortunately took a lot of hits on the front end. In hindsight, you know, we probably would have done a lot of those things different. And in the interview, there still is some scars. There's still some deep-seated feelings from various party members in terms of Huey leadership, in terms of Eldridge leadership. So I know I don't think that's a fair articulation on Huey. I think Huey was a genius. He made some mistakes, like everyone have.
Did he brutalize other members as he was accused of doing, people like Bobby Seale?
Well, I didn't personally see that myself, so I can't, you know, sustain that actually what happened. But I didn't see him brutalize anyone, no.
It's interesting that Bobby Seale has gone on to be very active in the community, much in the way that you are.
Yes.
Are you
yes.
in touch with him? Do you ever get in touch with
last
him?
Last time I saw Bobby was maybe a couple years ago. A few years back, we had a reunion for our Seattle chapter. Hmm. And, you know, Big Man was there, Bobby was there, and a couple other members of the Seattle chapter of the Black Panther Party. So that's the last time I actually spoke to him.
Let's take a call from Rocky in Mount Lebanon at 412-246-2002. Hi, Rocky. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was in Vietnam at the same time as your speaker was.
Mr. Birdsong, yes?
Yes, and I'm just now reading We Got to Get Out of This Place about the music of Vietnam.
Yes.
And it was reviewed on NPR. That's when it's really a fabulous book about that period in the music.
Yes.
But one of the things it mentioned in the book was that all of the soldiers there, all the military, were raised during the civil rights movement. And you had a mixture of people who were pro-civil rights and anti-civil rights together in the same place, in which caused a lot of tension. And I was wondering how he felt about that.
Well, that's a great question, Rocky. How did you feel about it, Rashad?
Well, like I said, until I went to Vietnam, I really didn't have that level of understanding. I had heard about, you know, the civil rights movement like most of us had, Martin Luther King, but I hadn't really engaged because I was very young. I went into the service when I was 17 years old. So I was in Vietnam in 68 when Martin Luther King was killed. My level of political consciousness came at that time period. I think the frustration was, in terms of what you're talking about, at some point, SCLC, that Martin represented, there was young people that came out at from SNCC. And the young people more was about the radical tradition opposed to, you know, the tradition that Martin was talking about. And I think that led to some of the differences in the approach of pro or con. But I know the folks that I had was in Vietnam with, and some of the young people around my age, that was part of the Malcolm X tradition. That was part of the Fannie Lou Hammer, Ella Baker tradition. Those was men and women that decided to take a strong stance and fight, you know, oppression back. So, you know, I'm sure we can go either way with that, but most of the folks that I had a relationship with came from that type of radical tradition and understanding.
You joined the Black Panthers when you were on the West Coast in Seattle, and later, as you mentioned, you got to the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. What do you know about the Black Panthers chapter in Pittsburgh? There was, I guess it wasn't an official chapter, but there was an office in Homewood Brushton. It got started around 1970. To what extent were they involved with the community issues here in Pittsburgh?
Well, here in the city, they was involved also in various issues. Matter of fact, the influence of the Black Panther Party tentacles touched throughout the country, particularly when Huey P. Newton campaigned Free Huey. And that echo touched a lot of young people, a lot of sentiment from all over the country.
He had spent years in prison.
A few years in prison. And a lot of chapters began to open up. And there was no way that we really could secure all those chapters. In other words, screen the people that was becoming a Panther. So what happened was we stopped, you know, actually chapters from being built. And we started building what was called National Centers for Combat Fascism. So in the 70s, I think 70, 71, actually there was no new Black Panther chapters started in the country because of the infiltration, you know, of agents in those chapters.
How much did the U.S. government surveillance and infiltration of FBI informants to sabotage the Black Panthers contribute to the collapse of the party?
It was every single day. They had our telephones tapped. They knew all of the vehicles that we drove. They identified every network and supporter that we had, and it was continued harassment 24/7. Every time that we was out in the car, it was stopped. Whenever we try to open up, you know, for a free breakfast program, they would go to the people that have the building and stop us from there. So it was constant these type of things that helped move towards the dismantling. And not to mention some of the real nasty type stuff. There was comrades that actually was assassinated. There was folks that were sent to jail on trumped up charges. There was times when the FBI had called different people and wrote different people, so-called, about what someone else had said to them or done to them. So we wasn't exposed. We were still young, like I said. So a lot of these things was new to us in terms with the government and the state apparatus actually would do to destabilize a movement.
If the Black Panthers had been able to continue to carry out their mission, would we be seeing essentially the same police brutality that sparked the formation of the Black Panthers inflicted on African Americans today?
Well, I would like to think no. And one of the reasons I'm saying that, because all of the survival programs that we created now are traditional and institutional. When you start talking about free breakfast for children and lunch for children, that's mainstream. When you be getting a look at the health centers, that's in our community, primary care, we started doing that. We begin testing for sickle cell anemia. That's in our communities. We begin to look at food banks. That's now traditional. So all those things are things that we started that's institutional now. So I would like to believe in starting, you know, the defensive movement in terms of police abuse, we also would have had maybe some gangs in terms of how best institutionalize that also.
I don't know if this is a fair characterization, but the Black Panthers in many ways were seen as largely working outside the system. Would you say that more progress can be made working within the system for community and social reform as you are now doing as president and CEO of the Community Empowerment Association in Homewood and other organizations you're involved with? Got about a minute.
I think that we got to do both. You got to be some outside the system work and some within the system work. We have to be the bridges. We have to be able to build social capital in the community, but also in traditional institutions that garnish most of the resources in this country.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds, so I will ask you what you thought of the PBS documentary about the Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution.
I think it was a good start in terms of exposing to the broader community the history of the Black Panther Party, but I don't think that the story had been completely told. There's an old African proverb that said, until the lion tell the story of the hunt would never be told. There's still a lot of lions out there that was exposed to this movement that haven't told the story yet.
So you say that there's still more to the story?
Oh, no question. No question.
We have been talking with T. Rashad Birdsong, a member of the Black Panthers who joined the party in 1968 after serving in Vietnam. He is a Pittsburgh native and is now the president and CEO of the Community Empowerment Association in Homewood. T. Rashad Birdsong, thank you so much for being with us, sharing your story with us, and clinging
us in. Thank you for having me.
About a lot of the history of the Black Panthers. It's been fascinating.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.